Well, thanks to Paul and to Sandy and everyone associated with the Stanford Biodesign Program for what I think continues to be a really fascinating series. And tonight I know will be no different. To a very large degree, the executives that we've interviewed in this series have tended to fall into one of two groups, a classic physician entrepreneur, or executives from very large companies who, in the course of a lengthy career, have made a substantial mark on the medical device industry. And with tonight's guest, we introduce a third kind of executive, what we might call the Young Turks, a breed of executives who are running the next generation of major medical device companies, the companies that will rival, if not replace, Medtronic, Boston Scientific, Guidance of the past generation. Mike Baker of Arthrocare is, in my experience, I've known Mike for a long time, one of the most thoughtful and also one of the most successful of this generation with a fascinating story to tell. And the fact that he spent the early part of his career at one of the giants, at Medtronic, I think only adds to the interest in this story. So Mike, thanks for coming, and we're very glad to have you here. You have an educational background that's unique among the folks who've graced this stage. Where'd you go to college, and why did you choose that college?
My undergraduate degree is in economics and engineering, and it's from the United States Military Academy at West Point. I guess if I had known how difficult it was going to be at West Point, I probably would have chickened out and gone to school somewhere else. But I was 17 years old and didn't have a whole lot of sense, and I'd never been any further north than Arkansas, and had this opportunity to attend this august institution in New York, and by doing so, get a chance to see the world, and it seemed like the grand adventure at the time, and so off I went.
Before we get to the business career, I know West Point and the training you went through, rigorous as it was, must have had an influence both on your schooling and also your career as an executive. Give us a sense of what kind of influence you think West Point had on you.
Well, I mean, it's a tremendous developmental experience and across all aspects of being a human being, and a very intense one, which I think can really help you grow up and get to know yourself very well and find out what you're capable of and what you're not capable of. And of course, the experience of both all of the military stuff and then all of the active duty stuff gives you some wonderful data points for misery that really serve you for the rest of your life. So on the worst day at work today, I think to myself, well, let's see, I've eaten in the last 24 hours, I slept in a bed last night, I'm not wet, I'm not cold, and I'm going home to sleep in a bed again tonight, so just how bad can this be? All kidding aside, it is an amazing institution, as all the academies are, and I think the vast majority of the graduates end up serving in civilian life, and I think they've delivered a lot of value to the country over the years.
You once described to me as an interesting combination of leadership and teamwork that makes the Army work.
Well, I think that's true of all the services. Not many Americans serve in uniform these days, and so there's a lot of us don't have a direct experience of what it's like. And I think it's probably a little bit different than you see in the cinema. You know, you see Full Metal Jacket or Gomer Pyle or something, and you think it's about a lot of yelling and screaming and giving orders. In reality, I think in the 5 years I was on active duty, I can only remember giving maybe two orders. Most of it's about understanding your people and your people understanding you and working together to try to do what can be very difficult things to exacting standards, sometimes under very difficult circumstances. And that's all about trust and about teamwork, and it's more about leadership than it is about sort of bureaucratic or dictatorial management. People don't follow you when they're tired or when they're being asked to do something that's difficult or when they're scared because they're afraid you're going to punish them. They follow you because they trust you and because they understand that what they're doing is important. And so I think the actual experience of service is a little bit different than it's portrayed sometimes in film.
So you're here, obviously, because you did make the transition to a career in business. How seriously did you consider a career in the Army, and what made you decide against it?
Well, before I went to West Point, I would never have thought of doing a career in the Army. I actually thought about it when I was on active duty because I was pretty good at it. And I did have the opportunity to go back to graduate school with the Army and go back to West Point and teach. And if I had done that, I'd probably still be in uniform today. But I had a three-year-old child at the time that my five-year commitment was up. And the life of a line officer in any of the services is a very difficult life for your family because you're gone almost continuously. The first year that I was on active duty, I was actually gone overnight 288 days. I know because my wife counted every day. And I wasn't, you know, in a business meeting somewhere staying in a hotel. I was really gone. So when I came home, I was, you know, kind of had a giant bag of dirty laundry and wanted to do nothing but sleep. And so I think it was just a very difficult, it's a very difficult life for the families of service members. And when I reached my five-year point, I had an opportunity to go to graduate school at the University of Chicago and work for First Chicago Corporation at the same time I was doing it. And I thought that that would be both an interesting opportunity, a lot of fun, and a lot more, give me a lot more balance in my life as far as my family went.
So your first two careers before you got to Medtronic were First Chicago and the Carroll Group. What, tell us about those two groups that you worked for.
Well, at First Chicago, I was a corporate development officer, which meant that I bought and sold things. I was doing M&A work. And we sold a few things and we bought a few things. And then I got my degree from the University of Chicago, an MBA in finance, and immediately got hired to be a consultant for a kind of a boutique consulting firm in Chicago that was also doing M&A work. And we were working for mostly giant companies that were doing big M&A deals. And that was sort of the job that everybody in the mid-80s thought they wanted. All the MBA graduates all wanted to go work for some boutique consulting firm doing these big deals. It was the era of Gordon Gekko, you know, and everyone wanted to be doing that kind of stuff. I found pretty quickly that I was relatively miserable being a consultant. I mean, I was pretty good at the work, but in my heart of hearts, I'm a line dog. I like to work with people. I like to work with teams of people to do something that's going to be of lasting value, and I don't like feeling like I'm just a hired gun coming in to solve a problem or to get paid and then go somewhere else. And so when the opportunity came to go to work for Medtronic, which was an unbelievably fortunate opportunity for me because it was at a pivotal point of that company's development and a pivotal point in my career, I was really happy to take it and jump at it.
How did you get to Medtronic? What was the path that got you there? Was you just at, were you recruited? Did you answer an ad? Did you work for them at the Carroll Group?
I was really, really lucky. We had a couple of medical device clients, and so I knew enough about the industry to know that I was interested in the industry because to me it combined, and to me it still does, it combined the opportunity to work on truly important scientific and medical problems, at the same time work on interesting engineering and technical problems. And yes, it's a regulated industry that has a lot of issues in terms of regulation and reimbursement and all that stuff, but at the end of the day, the work is interesting, and if you do your job right, you can do something that touches the lives of literally millions of people in a positive way, and you can make some money doing it. And so that, to me, it was a very attractive industry, and Medtronic was a very attractive company. And I was lucky enough to get sort of a call from a headhunter when they were looking for someone to join them in sort of the corporate planning area.
What did corporate planning entail at Medtronic in those days? And was it a new function or were you inventing it? Because Medtronic would, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, would then go on for the next several years to evolve well beyond the CRM and pacemaker company that
right.
It was for much of its years prior to that.
This was 1989, and Bill George had just joined as the chief operating officer. Glenn Nelson was there as vice chairman. Win Wallen right then was serving as the CEO, and Bill Chorsky was the CFO then. And Bill was the guy who was probably most instrumental in getting me hired. The strategic planning function, which is what I ultimately came to run in the first year or so I was there, was really evolving at a rapid rate and was becoming much more adventurous in terms of thinking about how the company could be steered strategically. And it was a tremendous time to go to work for a company with that kind of opportunity, staffed out by those kinds of leaders, looking at you know, that kind of blank sheet of paper and thinking about what might be done. And I think Wynn and Bill and Glenn laid out this fabulous vision for what they wanted the company to be, and I got to be part of turning their vision into plans that people could execute and ultimately learned an enormous amount while doing it.
Talk a little about Medtronic at that time. I mean, it was a fascinating group of executives. Bill George wasn't the CEO at the time. He was COO
right.
when you joined.
Right.
Tell us about when Bill George, your impressions of those guys, your memories, and particularly Glenn Nelson, who was a fascinating guy. I'm not certain how well known he is in this industry, but had major impact on the U.S. healthcare system.
Glenn is something special. He was my boss for a long time, and I'll say for the record, he is a fabulous boss.
Mm-hmm.
He's brilliant. He's a great mentor. He gives you the space to do what you can do. You know, he lays out for you the boundary conditions and the vision, and then really challenges you to do something more than maybe you thought you could do. And he, along with those other guys, was willing to take a chance on someone like me, who was relatively young, who didn't really know the industry, and sort of everything that I showed them that I was willing to try and able to do, I got a chance to do more. And that was an unbelievable opportunity for me.
Wynn Wallins, because we don't, again, we tend to associate Medtronic with the Bill George era, mm-hmm. but who was Wynn? And
Wynn was the CEO before Bill, and he was actually the CEO when I became the strategic planning person. And Wynn knew a lot about being a good CEO. He knew how to let the operating people operate the company, and he knew when, as CEO, he was supposed to say something or do something. And in my experience, he was invariably laser-like in his ability to be on target with a comment at a critical moment that would be just exactly right. And would, mm-hmm. you know, so you'd have this ferocious debate going on around a table about whether we should do something or not, or how we should do it, or whatever. And Wynn would say nothing for the majority of it. And then at the end of it, he would just make one sentence, and everyone would look at each other and think, Jesus, he's right. <You know? laughs> and that would be kind of the end of the discussion, and we would all be on the same page. So he wasn't at all a micromanager. He was very much a big picture guy. And I really thought they did the corporate succession thing very well, because when Bill was ready to step up and be CEO, Wynn stepped back and became an executive chairman, and he really did step back. He didn't muddle in the operating details of the business at all. He moved back into a really strategic role as chairman. He helped with corporate governance and managing the board, and then he would sort of pick one big project at a time that had the potential to add real value to the company, and then he would sort of lead it. And so, you know, the two of them were a great partnership, and mm-hmm. I think that model works very well. And I know a lot of corporate governance people would say, oh, you should never have an executive chairman who used to be a CEO. I don't know. I've seen it work extremely well a couple of times, where especially if the executive chairman's willing to step back from the operating business and do it with as much sort of grace as Wynn did it. And then, of course, Bill stepped up to be CEO, and the legacy speaks for itself. I mean, it's a... he led Medtronic through that period of extraordinary expansion and growth with not only very thoughtful strategic plans, but with tremendous character, sort of value-driven leadership. But he was very bold, and I think probably was willing to do things that other companies could have done, but weren't willing to work up the gumption to do.
Now, he came from Litton. He did not come, in fact,
true.
Was it Honeywell?
From Honeywell.
Honeywell. He and did not have a healthcare background. How did he adapt into in an environment in which everybody else were? I mean, Glenn Nelson was a physician.
But Bill's a pretty quick study, mm-hmm. as I'm sure you know from meeting him. I mean, Bill has a tremendous appetite for information and a tremendous capacity to learn. And he's also, and this is not, you know, this is not hyperbole, he is a real, genuine human being and a real authentic sort of leader. And always sort of lives and exemplifies the values that he espouses. You know, I never came away from a conversation with Bill, even if it was about a difficult subject, without the feeling that that he really genuinely cared about me and the people that I was responsible for leading as human beings, and wanted to see the best for us, and that he really believed in the values of the company. And you know, in the medical device industry. We're a special industry. We have the opportunity to do all these wonderful things, and we have the opportunity to touch people's lives in a positive way, and we have a chance to make some good money if we do it right. But we have an awesome responsibility, because the products that we make and the services we provide are going to touch people's lives. And you have to put the interests of your patients and your physician customers in front of the interests of the company, and I think that's unique American capitalist public companies. I mean, most other companies, you worry about your customers, but you wouldn't sacrifice the shareholders because you had an upset customer somewhere.
It's interesting that you describe Bill George that way, because he has a self-confessed reputation for being a real stern taskmaster and sometimes being hard on people. Did you not experience that with him? And you know, Glenn Nelson, it was such a gentle soul in a lot of respects.
Yeah, Bill can be tough, but never tough in an abusive way. I mean, Bill never sets a standard he's not willing to live up to himself, mm-hmm. and to me, there's nothing wrong with that. I actually think Bill is a pretty introspective guy in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. and I've seen Bill make tough decisions, and you know, make tough calls and set tough standards, but I've never seen Bill be unfair with someone.
By the late 1990s, which was after you left, 1998, Medtronic would begin transforming itself from a pacemaker company, a cardiac rhythm management company, to an extremely broad-based, diversified device companies, Sofmordanic, Zomed, Minimed, AVE. Was there any inclination in the M&A work and corporate development work that you were doing in the early 1990s that Medtronic was soon to undergo that kind of transition? In contrast, for instance, to an organization like Guidant, which for its entire, did a lot of deals, but for its entire run, was a cardiovascular device company.
Now, we were already looking at and moving into areas outside of cardiac rhythm management in the mid-90s. We had the coronary vascular business, which we'd had for a while. We had the neurological business, which, while it was one of the smaller businesses when I was there, was widely seen as a business with some very big opportunities in front of it, many of which have now played out. And in fact, one of the jobs I had at Medtronic was running the venture division, which was specifically chartered to go looking at areas outside of sort of the cardiac rhythm management, even cardiovascular area in some cases, at things like women's health, ENT, to look and see if there were opportunities to build businesses around proprietary technology that we could be good at that could solve medical problems that weren't being well addressed.
And was there a strategy or philosophy, or was it basically whatever looked good, you guys would take a chance on?
No, there was definitely a strategic framework. And the company may, like all companies, you want to be opportunistic against that framework, but you need to be very disciplined to stay within the framework of what you believe is ultimately going to make sense. You can't be all things to all people. Otherwise, you end up sort of dissipating your impact, and you're not going to be successful if you do that.
So give us a sense of what were some of the deals that you worked on in the corporate, before we get to the venture group, in the corporate development M&A work in the early 1990s at Medtronic?
Well, we bought Synectics Medical, which was a company that did really diagnostic equipment for ENT, gastroenterology, and also for some urology and gynecology applications. We bought CardiRhythm, which was more of a cardiovascular type company. That was a RF ablation cardiac arrhythmia outfit. We sold a couple of companies. We sold a monitoring company in New York, and then we also sold a small ionophoretic drug delivery division to Alza up the road here. And then we actually did some landmark and extremely large intellectual property deals in those days that really sort of sorted out the whole cardiac rhythm management business.
One was with Lilly.
That was the one that went all the way to the Supreme Court, and we had the experience of winning a case at the Supreme Court and then having to negotiate this big high stakes settlement, really. And the other one was with Siemens, Siemens Pacesetters. And the chance for someone at that point in my career and at that age to get to be a member of a team, albeit a minor one, but working on those kinds of deals and to get to be a part of listening to how people think about that and understanding how this kind of stuff works is, for me, it was an invaluable experience.
And we'll get to it in just a second, but sorting through those kind of patent issues, litigation issues, would be an important part of the Arthrocare story. Mm-hmm. Talk about the venture group at Medtronic that you formed. I understand it somewhat came out of the CardioRhythm acquisition when the board challenged you and asked you why you were doing this deal.
Well, we bought CardioRhythm, and CardioRhythm is a good company, and it was a successful acquisition. But one of the questions the board asked, and it was a really good question, they said, well, why are we buying this company? Looking at the technology, we can see it's a good product. We can see it's going to be a good deal for us. But we could have developed this product ourselves. I mean, there's nothing here that we didn't know how to do. So why did we end up having to buy this company? And so then they turned to me as the staff guy and said, answer the question. And I ended up writing a paper that said basically the reason that breakthrough therapies, new therapies, don't get developed well at large companies is because large companies are focused on the most important next product. And the most important next product in any division of a large company is the next iteration of your core product line that's going to generate revenue next quarter. And so all the money, the best people, the management attention is always focused on those kinds of projects. And the great, interesting, potentially breakthrough, brilliant therapy ideas that are in the brains of some of the scientists at large companies end up getting kind of fooled around with in the back room, and they never really get brought to market very quickly. A small company that's focused on doing nothing but that will get to market before you, and then you're going to end up having to buy them. And the board guys all kind of shook their head, and they thought that that was right. And they said, so what if we wanted to do this? How would we do it? And I went away for a while, and I wrote a white paper that that actually sort of became my job description, that said that if you were going to actually try to do that kind of innovation inside a large company, you had to do it completely offline of the main business. You had to almost set up sort of a skunkworks type organization, preferably in a separate building, with dedicated funding, with renegade leadership that would be willing to sort of, you know, break the rules if necessary, and the corporate rules, not the legal rules, and then give them the mission and the charter to go do these kind of things, and give them special comp plans that would reward them if they pulled it off, just like you would have in a startup company. And ultimately, that's what they asked me to do. And so
we were the first employee.
I was employee number one, and I was allowed to hire anybody inside of Medtronic I wanted, which did not endear me to some of the large divisions, because I hired some of their best technical people. Mm-hmm. And we were allowed full access to all of the factories and labs at Medtronic, which was an enormous advantage, because we could get in and use equipment or labs that small companies would have given their eye teeth to get access to. And of course, we had access to all of the consultants that Medtronic worked with, who were really some incredibly brilliant and experienced people in various areas of medicine. And we had a dedicated budget every year that I didn't have to argue about. I had a certain amount of money that I had every year, and I knew I was going to have. And I had a board of directors, which Glenn was the chairman of, which approved how we spent it.
And how much of these projects were, how many of these projects or what distribution were internal projects, scientists who, within Medtronic or engineers who had an interesting idea but couldn't get it past what you actually once called the tyranny of the short-term expectations that the companies have.
It is a bit tyrannical.
And how much outside?
You know, most of them were internal ideas, mm-hmm. and most of them were based upon technology that Medtronic already had in-house. And we would get these idea presentations, and we would listen to them, and we would decide which ones we were going to fund. And an internal venture, we operated like a little incubator. Some of the ventures were as small as two or three people. Some were as big as, I think near the end, we had some that were as big as 50 people, and even had some Salesforce, you know, people out selling stuff. But most of the ideas came from inside. And then we were also allowed to make minority investments in small companies on the outside, if we thought that would give us access to a complementary product or a technology. Because the idea was that when the smoke cleared, you would have an internally developed product that would be sort of a flagship product, and you could maybe fill in around that with some other products you had found on the outside, either through minority investment or acquisition, and you'd end up with a brand new standalone division in a new area of medicine.
So hiring folks aside, how were you greeted within Medtronic? Were you welcomed with open arms by the operating companies, or do they see you as somewhat of a threat?
No, I think, I ask people at Medtronic, I think most of them will tell you they have a pretty positive opinion of me. I'm a pretty innocuous guy. But, I mean, and I understand exactly how a line division guy feels, because I've run line divisions at Medtronic, too. When the venture group hires out your best scientist, you know, and you're not going to be happy about that. But my comeback to that always was, this guy really wants to do this project. He's got some passion about it. If you don't let me hire him to do it, he's going to end up going to work for some startup venture company to do it. And then we'll lose him to the company. It's better that we do this ourselves, and let's give this guy the freedom to pursue it, and you know, it'll be properly supervised. And oh, by the way, when he's successful, you can have the product. Because that was the deal. If the product fit within one of the core businesses, that's who got to commercialize it when the research work was done. And actually, I guess probably the biggest successes in the venture group ended up being things that went back into a core business.
We'll talk about some of those, because by the time, you know, within a couple of years, you had a couple hundred people there, you were generating real revenues, it was profitable for Medtronic. What were some of the technologies that you brought into Medtronic or helped introduce into Medtronic?
Well, I didn't so much bring them in. We brought the ideas out of the divisions and then did them and put them back in. So a lot of the sophisticated sensor work that ended up being the heart of the heart failure pacers and the multi-chamber defibrillators,
CRT.
All those kind of things were actually projects that at one time or another were venture-funded projects. And the incontinence product, the InterStim product that Medtronic now has, was actually a product that was pulled out of the neuro division, developed and commercialized by the venture group, and then later after I left the company, went back to the neuro division. So. We did some interesting work in ENT that actually never got commercialized.
So you did that for a couple of years, and then you left to go to Arthrocare, which came about as a result of a conversation with a neighbor of yours in California. Tell us that story.
Well, I got transferred to San Diego to run the coronary vascular business. And so I was living the life of Riley. I was living in San Diego, working in I guess the plant was in La Jolla, and I lived in Rancho Santa Fe. So nothing was bad about this arrangement. And life was good, but I had a neighbor who was an arthroscopic surgeon, and our kids would play, and I remember sitting in the backyard one night talking to him, watching the sun go down, and the balloons are drifting by, and we're sipping a glass of wine. And he asked me if I knew anything about stock, and I told him enough to lose money, basically, and that's pretty much he said, no, really, because there was this new product that he and his friends, his surgeon buddies, were using, and it was this tremendously good product. They loved it, and they were buying more and more of it. And so they thought, well, we'll buy some stock in the company that makes it. And they had bought stock in the company. And he said he couldn't understand because the stock kept going down while they kept buying more and more product. And they couldn't understand why this was happening. And I said, okay, what's the name of the company? And he said, Arthrocare. And I just about choked because I had spent the last month deleting voicemail messages from headhunters and people who wanted to talk to me about Arthrocare and possibly going to work there because I wasn't really interested in going anywhere. And I went and watched him operate. I ended up finally convincing myself to at least talk to Hira and was very impressed by what I saw and ultimately decided that this was something I had to try to do.
So it couldn't, before we get to Arthrocare, it couldn't have been easy to leave Medtronic. We talked a little earlier about the influence and the lessons you took away from West Point. I know Medtronic must also have been a major influence. Can you describe or sum up what your experience at Medtronic was like? What do you think you took away from that experience?
Well, just a tremendously positive experience. I would never have been ready to take this challenge on, nor would anyone in their right mind have offered it to me if it had not been for all of the mentorship and good leadership that I received during the time I was at Medtronic. I mean, they consistently gave me opportunities to do things that were more and more challenging, more and more interesting, and I think really good companies do that. And there was an extraordinary group of people there at that company during that period of time who took chances on me. And, I'm sure they were not happy to see me leave, but at the same time, they have all, I'm pretty certain, been rooting for me since I've been over here at Arthrocare.
Mm-hmm. Well, Arthrocare eventually would make its name in arthroscopy, as your neighbor's experience, but it started as a cardiovascular company. Was it an orthopedic company by the time you joined it?
It was orthopedic.
It started as AngioCare.
It started as AngioCare, and it was funny. Paul and I were laughing on the drive over here. He was telling me that he saw some of the early AngioCare products and was concerned for the future of the company, probably rightly so. But the technology was very good technology and very, very original technology, pioneering type technology, and you don't see that very often in medical devices. And so what attracted me to it was not really just the opportunity to develop, a nice arthroscopy business focused in orthopedics, but looking at the technology, I could envision potentially doing a lot of different things with it over time. And to me, that was a much more interesting proposition, because then you could see yourself having this technology become a platform upon which you could build a multi-business company, and you could add other interesting things to it over time. And that ultimately was a key factor in my decision to take the chance on this.
So just in case anybody who doesn't know Arthrocare, the key is a plasma-mediated technology. Give us a brief overview of Arthrocare's technology.
Well, if you were to pick up a physics textbook from 10 years ago, they would tell you that what we do is not possible. And I think our founder may be here with us tonight, so if I get the technical description wrong here, you chime in and straighten me out. The technology basically is a way to create and stabilize a gas plasma at more or less room temperature and atmospheric pressure at the tip of a surgical instrument, and then the plasma has enough energy in it that you can actually dissolve tissue. So you're not burning the tissue, you're actually doing what's something that you could call molecular dissociation. You're turning the big molecules of the tissue into small molecules, and that ends up being extremely precise and very atraumatic and relatively flexible from an engineering standpoint, because you can actually make instruments that are very tiny, or you can make instruments that are very large and very aggressive. And that gives you a range of capabilities, which is not the cure for death, but it does allow you to design instruments that are useful in a relatively wide variety of surgical applications, particularly as medicine becomes less invasive and more endoscopic oriented. Because as you're operating inside a confined space or you're operating next to a delicate structure, precision, good visibility, lack of inadvertent trauma to surrounding tissue are all big positives. And if you have a lot of engineering flexibility in the way you design the product, and you can make it multifunctional, maybe including onboard suction or mechanical capabilities or irrigation, then so much the better. Then you've got a much more useful instrument that can speed up operations, make them easier, and make it easier for patients to recover from. So it's a pretty interesting technology, and it was, in fact, discovered by our founders and patented and is owned by Arthrocare.
Mm-hmm. So plasma mediation is a very powerful tool. In fact, in certain procedures, it's actually changed the way surgeons operate. If you talk to a lot of veterans of surgical product companies, they will tell you that surgeons are extremely conservative. They like to do things the way they've always done them. Mm-hmm. Tactile sense is very important to them. How do you get adoption in that kind of environment? How do you convince surgeons that there's a new and better way to do things?
Well, in the beginning, the company focused on an arthroscopy application that was just a really messy, time-consuming, unpleasant part of shoulder surgery called subacromial decompression, where you endoscopically go into the shoulder and you remove soft tissue from underneath the acromion bone, and then you have to take down part of the bone, and you're doing all this to create some space inside the joint, and then you can do your tissue repair. The problem with doing it before Arthrocare came along was that you had to go in there with a mechanical shaver and you began taking tissue off the bone, and then it began bleeding, and then you couldn't see. And so then you had to start trying to flush the joint with some non-conductive fluid so then you could go back in with a Bovie and try to stop the bleeders. And then you'd pull the Bovie out and go back in with the shaver and open the bleeders up again by taking off some more tissue. And so you can imagine changing instruments back and forth and flushing the joint with saline and then flushing it again with non-conductive. And it was messy and time-consuming and a real pain to do. And then out comes the Arthrocare device, the one my neighbor was using. And you can, with this device, you can operate in saline because it's a bipolar plasma device, not a classic electrosurgical device. And it will dissolve the tissue very rapidly, and you can clean the bone right off. And if you happen to have a bleeder, you simply move the device over the bleeder, move your foot to the different pedal, to a different pedal. You get a different electrical signal on the tip. It doesn't form a plasma anymore. What you've got is bipolar coag, and you stop the bleeder. So you would take maybe 45 minutes out of a shoulder operation. And you're right, surgeons are very used to using the tools they learned in residency, but if you take a guy through one operation with a tool that speeds the operation up by 45 minutes, you get their attention really quickly. And that was really the key to the early success of the company, was bringing out an instrument that made a painful, messy procedure faster and easier, and it caught on.
You once said to me that in 1997, when you joined the company, most people were betting that Arthrocare wouldn't make it. Why? What were some of the challenges it faced at the time? And obviously, the next obvious question is, you know, what turned it around?
Well, I think if you'd gone to Vegas in 1997 and gotten the odds on our survival, they'd have been pretty long. Because that year we did about $6 million in revenue. We were not profitable. We had less than $20 million in the bank. And Johnson & Johnson had just introduced a copy of our system in the field of arthroscopy. And Johnson & Johnson had a sales force that numbered in the hundreds, and they had big product line and lots of other products to sell and lots of marketing dollars, and we had basically nothing. And so a lot of people were thinking that we weren't going to survive. The patents that covered the basic technology had not yet issued at the time I joined the company. They issued about 6 months after I joined the company, and that was a key part of my assessment that the patents were going to be enforceable and valid was a key part of my assessment that we had a chance to make it. Mm-hmm. That, and I also felt that it was possible for us to do some things in product development near term that would create a durable performance advantage in our system over the J&J system, so that even while the case was going through court, you know, it doesn't do any good to win a patent infringement case and go broke in the process, because it's kind of a moot point, right? If you're broke and the other guys have won in the marketplace, the courtroom battle doesn't really matter. So the most important thing was to win in the marketplace, which meant we had to really do some serious product development work to enhance the performance of our system and create a durable performance advantage so that we could win in the marketplace and survive long enough to win in court. And ultimately, we did both. We launched sort of a very high-stakes crash product development effort and developed what became known as the System 2000, which we introduced in November of 1997, which had a big performance advantage over the system J&J was selling then, and turned the situation around in the marketplace. And we were able to regain market share, and then ultimately we won the legal action too.
I want to come back to the litigation in just a second. One of the criticisms of Arthrocare at the time was that it was unfocused and didn't really know what it wanted to do.
Sure.
It started as a cardiovascular company. Now it's talking about orthopedics, also had plays in other areas. Did you see that multi-directional capability as a strength of plasma mediation, or did you agree with the critics that the company was not focused and not disciplined?
Well, long term, I think the ability to do a lot of different things is strategically a big part of why we've been able to grow so fast for 10 years. I mean, the first 10 years the company was around, we averaged almost 40% a year growth. That's a phenomenal number, and you can't do that if you don't have opportunities outside of your core application. The problem in 1997 was we were trying to do too many things at once. Mm-hmm. And we were doing arthroscopy, but at the same time that we were trying to compete with J&J, we had a massive back order of product. We could not manufacture enough product to meet demand. And we were running research projects in ENT, spine, urology, cosmetic surgery, and some cardiology applications. And that's just too much stuff to try to do at one point. So we had to make the decision, and we made it really before I even joined the company. I made the decision that we were going to focus on winning in arthroscopy because that would allow us to survive, and then there would be time to do the other things that we thought we could do. And that's kind of how it's played out. We built we won in arthroscopy and built a big successful business there. And since then, we were able to build a business in ENT. It's now become one of the market leaders in ENT surgery and really driven some radical change in that marketplace. And now we're just now seeing our spine business begin to get real traction, and just announced in the last quarter that we're going to start moving into the area of sort of interventional oncology. So we're still interested in doing a lot of different things. The question is, you got to make sure you're not doing too many things at once. You've got to make sure that you've got three profitable businesses before you can start a new money-losing business, I guess, is one way to think about it.
As we mentioned, there's been this kind of theme through your career of wrestling with the issue of litigation and patent protection around IP. At Arthrocare, you developed a very interesting litigation to licensing deal kind of strategy, eventually doing deals with J&J, Smith & Nephew. Did you also do one with Stryker?
J&J, Stryker, and most recently Smith & Nephew.
So talk about those deals and how they came out of the litigation. And I guess if you were confident that your IP was on your side, why do deals with your competitors? Why not just take them to court and beat them there?
Well, in some cases, we have done that. I mean, we actually went all the way to an enforced legal injunction against Smith & Nephew. Every decision, strategic decision, about when and if to settle and on what terms to settle or to license is very unique. And the context of where the company is in its development, who it is you're talking about licensing, how you feel about the competitiveness of your product set long-term versus theirs, they all weigh very heavily on that. I mean, in 1998, when we agreed right before the trial was going to start to settle with J&J and to license them, two things were important. One of them was we were confident that our system was a higher performance system and we could hold our own in the marketplace and that we could compete very effectively with them despite their advantages in numbers of salespeople, marketing dollars, and complementary products. I was also very cognizant of the fact that we were still an unprofitable company and that the cost to actually go through the trial and get an enforceable injunction would be significant, and it would be a long time before we actually got any damages money. Finally, though, I think there are points in time where having a licensed competitor, particularly if that competitor's product set is maybe not as competitive as yours, is not necessarily a negative if that competitor is the kind of company that J&J is, with an enormously positive clinical reputation. So, you know, it's not a bad thing when you're out trying to convince doctors to try a plasma surgery instrument and they're still questioning you about the physics of plasma instruments and whether they're really real or not, to have the baby shampoo company marketing the same message. And that's pretty much what we ended up with after the licensing agreement. And you know, the decision making was different and the outcomes were different with both Stryker and Smith & Nephew, but ultimately, in a space like arthroscopy, to get maximum value from a technology, you want to make it standard of care. And if you can manage your licensing arrangements so that you and your competitors drive it to standard of care quickly, and you can manage your business in the marketplace so that you have leading market share, and at this point we have probably 60% brand market share, and the technology is becoming a standard of care. So you end up with leading brand share and a significant share of the profits of the other people you're licensing, then you can make an argument that that's a good value maximizing equation.
you know, litigation is extremely resource intensive, and you talk about going up against the maker of baby shampoo. At Medtronic, you had worked in the venture group, and so you'd worked a lot with small companies, but you also had the resources of Medtronic behind you. As you got to Arthrocare, do you think you were well-prepared or ill-prepared for working for a small company?
Well, I mean, the time I'd spent in the venture group was helpful, and I think probably the time I spent in the service was helpful, too. I remember one of the first board meetings I went to at Arthrocare, I had the temerity to suggest that since we had less than $20 million in the bank and we were still losing money, that perhaps we should consider, oh, and we were concerned that the expectations that the Street had for our financial performance were maybe a little bit too aggressive. I suggested that maybe we should lower those expectations and consider raising some money. And I was promptly informed that that wasn't why they had brought me there, and that we were going to get to cash flow positive with the money that we had. And we did, actually. We got to cash flow positive with the money that we had on hand then. So I mean, it's a, you know, when you have a good board, they establish appropriate boundary conditions, and then you have to be innovative within those boundary conditions. So,
recently, Arthrocare actually has been one of the more active acquirers in the medical device space, particularly in the spine space. You did Opus and a couple of other deals. Talk about your acquisition strategy. How much was it shaped or framed by what you did at Medtronic, and how important is acquisition going forward, given that you've got such an innovative technology in the plasma mediation? Is it harder to add external technologies into that kind of technology, or is it necessary in order to realize the full potential of it?
It's not easy, because if you've got a sales force that's selling sort of proprietary, best-in-class, premium-priced Buck Rogers kind of stuff, they don't get real excited about selling commodities. And so I'm not a big fan of bag-filling acquisitions where you just go out and try to get everything that you can sell to a given doctor and try to do that business that way. Nothing wrong with that. There are companies that do that and do it well, and there's value creation opportunities in trying to leverage a distribution channel, but that's really not what we're about. And in my experience, if you are an innovative company that's going to be driven by rapid new product development and you're going to try to develop some breakthrough therapies, you've got to have anything else you give your salespeople to sell has got to have an equivalent level of sizzle. And I'm also a big fan of not buying individual products. I'm a big fan of trying to buy other platform technologies that I can use to make a stream of products over time. To me, those are more attractive. And so I think we frustrate the investment bankers quite a bit, because we have a very we're very disciplined strategically in terms of thinking about how something might or might not fit into our strategic framework for acquisitions, and we probably look at 100 deals and seriously consider doing one. But when we find one that we think is good, we're aggressive. We're all over it.
Interesting, because a lot of large companies, particularly in orthopedics, actually take the exact opposite approach. I was talking to a biz dev guy at a large orthopedic company. He said, we only want products. We don't want to deal with the infrastructure integration. We don't want to deal with any of that stuff. We want stuff we can plug in, send to our sales force, and not deal with the rest of the stuff.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's a perfectly viable business strategy. It just happens to be 180 out of what we do. I'll give you a great example. Back in 2004, we bought Opus, which had a very hot product on the market at the time. It was a tissue fixation shoulder product, but what was different about it was that it was really a system that solved the most compelling serious problem that surgeons face in endoscopic orthopedic work, which is basically tissue anchoring, suturing, and knotting. Very difficult to do, very time-consuming. And it was really a technology platform that you could see applying not just to the initial product, but to a dozen products down the road in orthopedics and some outside of orthopedics. I got really excited about it. We got aggressive about it, and we were able to buy it, and it's been a successful acquisition. But the reason the story is relevant is I remember going to our sales meeting right after we had bought Opus to tell the salespeople we had done this. If I had gone to that sales meeting to tell them that we had bought any one of the dozen tissue anchor companies with conventional anchors that were currently on the market and were for sale at that point, I would have been greeted with yawns and a Bronx cheer. Mm-hmm. Because why would you bother selling a commodity product if you can spend your time selling a highly proprietary premium price product? Salespeople can do the math. They know where their time is more valuably spent. But when you come up there and tell them that you've acquired a platform, and oh, by the way, the first product off of it is this super hot product that you've all been hearing about, and we have an ambitious R&D plan to bring out a half a dozen more super hot products over the next couple of years, then their reaction to it is completely different. And so the challenge for us, I mean, we are going to do acquisitions as we find things that make sense, but The challenge for us is finding something that fits into that sort of way of thinking. And frankly, there aren't very many things that do. I mean, we've done just literally a handful in the last decade.
You know, I noted before that you had used this phrase with me once before, the big companies suffer the tyranny of short-term expectations. And you mentioned the importance for big companies of defending their franchise. That's explained why you do a venture group type thing at Medtronic and why a small company like Arthrocare can leapfrog its more mature competitors. But as Arthrocare gets bigger and as its own technology matures, do you see that from the opposite side? Do you feel now the pressure to defend a core technology?
Well, I mean, all companies can be subject to the tyranny of short-term expectations. All you have to do is listen to a quarterly conference call to get that take on it. The important thing for us to remain the kind of company that we have been, and if we want to continue to be successful, I really believe that we have to remain the kind of company that we've been, that if we allow our culture to change, if we allow the way we think about our business to change, then we will inevitably become a big company no matter what size we are. And so you've got to, instead of thinking defensively, you've got to think, I think, offensively, for want of a better word. And a lot of the things that we're doing, and we do a lot of things in product development and technology development, are really targeting and obsoleting our own current core products. And I think if you're dedicated to doing that, then you have a chance to stay innovative. And, you know, we do, I was telling one of you guys earlier, we do an average of about one new product a month, which is a phenomenal rate of new product introduction. A lot of them are relatively straightforward enhancements of existing products or broadening applications for existing products, but there's two or three of them a year that are real live attempts at doing something game-changing. And I think that's what you've got to keep doing if you want to stay the kind of entrepreneurial company that we've been. And you can't be afraid to try to do something bold or to try to obsolete your own most profitable, most successful product. Go ahead.
So you came into Arthrocare running a public company. What's the best thing about running a public company and the worst thing about running a public company?
In 1997 or now? Actually, you know what? It's every day of it has been a lot of fun, although I will say running a public company has become a lot less fun in the last 4 or 5 years. And at this point, some of you probably heard me say this, that if I had it to do over again, I probably would have stayed private, or if I'd had that opportunity.
Right.
Well, I mean, there's so many things in the environment of being a public company that are just so negative at this point. I mean, it's sort of the scandal du jour. You know, you've got all of these tremendous regulatory pressures from the SEC that didn't exist before. It's very difficult to talk openly to investors about anything. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on. And the cost of being a public company has risen dramatically. You know, even back in 97, it cost several million dollars a year for a company to be public instead of private. But now that number is probably, you know, 3 to 5x what it used to be and going higher. And the saddest part of it, from my perspective, is that certainly there was some pretty dramatic corporate misbehavior that occurred in the early part of this century and the last part of the last, most of which has been pretty thoroughly punished by laws that existed before all these new regulations were passed. And in all honesty, I don't see anything in the new regulations that's going to prevent someone who's a crook from doing it again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not sure that we've really helped ourselves or helped investors. What we've done is layer a lot of extra work and cost on top of a system that already was somewhat burdensome, and that's going to make it more difficult for young companies to do what Arthrocare did, which is go public at a relatively early age and be able to raise the capital you need to commercialize aggressively. And so that if we're not careful, that will be a net loss for the U.S. Economy over time.
It can't be lost on you that over the past 5 or 6 years, Arthrocare's stock price has risen significantly while Medtronic has been flat to a little bit down. This is where you're supposed to jump in with a comment here.
I'm supposed to comment
you're
on
supposed
this?
You're supposed to comment on that. How does Arthrocare differ as a public company
from
Medtronic? Are your challenges the same as Art Collins or Bill George's?
No, I think it's a very different job running a, you know, Medtronic at this point is not only a wonderful company, but it's a huge company. And trying to lead an organization of that size is a fundamentally different challenge than sort of doing what I do every day when I go to work. And, you know, I get a huge kick out of doing what I'm doing. We've had a tremendous amount of success in the last decade, and that has shown up in the stock price, which is something that I feel very good about, because I love coming to the facility in the morning and seeing that some employees have bought a new car, or knowing that they bought a new house, or knowing that their kids are in college, and that they're doing that because we've been successful, and that and as our shareholders have made money, they have also made money along with them, and then they're able to do the things in their lives that are going to make their lives better. And that, to me, that's a tremendous positive.
So we're right up against the time here. Let me ask one more question, then we'll open up to Q&A. ArthurCare is one of the few success stories from that group of medical device companies that went public in 95 and 96. Why do you think you've succeeded where others have not?
Well, another of my real good friends from back at Medtronic, Mike Elwine, who just retired there, I'll quote him on this occasion, and that is, he always used to tell me it's better to be lucky than good. And we've certainly had a lot of good fortune, and I've had the good fortune to work with just some excellent people. And but during the time at Medtronic when I was learning my trade, but especially during the last 10 years being CEO of ArthurCare, it's been a tremendous experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Mike, thank you very much. I think ArthurCare is a great story. Medtronic is a great story. We very much appreciate your being here today. Thank you.
My great pleasure.
Okay, we have a microphone here, and while people are getting to it, I'm going to take the prerogative to ask the first follow-on question. You recently moved ArthurCare to Austin, Texas, and I know that as part of that, you have some strong feelings about California's climate for growing and running a small company, and that's obviously of interest to folks here, many of whom are engaged in things. Why did you move to Austin, and what concerns you about California?
Well, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love California, especially on days like this. And I think that there's a tremendous pool of innovation and talent and here in the Bay Area that makes it the incubator for successful technology companies that it is. The problem we faced a couple of years ago was we had our manufacturing facility was in Costa Rica, which has been a tremendous success for us. Our headquarters and R&D center was here, and we were growing rapidly, but the main limitation in our growth was our ability to find enough of the right kind of people to do everything that we were trying to do. We were really struggling to hire enough people and to retain enough people to get things done. And time and again, we would find someone, that we really wanted to hire in some other part of the country or some other part of the world, and we just could not convince them to move to the Bay Area because of the cost of housing or the cost of living or because they were concerned about schools for their kids. And I think that's the downside of the Bay Area. It is kind of a superheated environment. And once you're here and you've lived here for a while, you get used to it. But it's really tough to move people in here. And we ultimately made the decision that we needed a second U.S. location. And so we opened a headquarters and an R&D center in Austin, Texas, which is also a nice town and happens to be about halfway between Costa Rica and here. And we've been growing that center. But at the same time, we extended the lease in our campus here by 10 years. Renovated it, and we continue to have a campus here of about the same size. So we're not planning on leaving the Bay Area. We just are kind of trying to be realistic about how much can we grow here, given the things that make it expensive to grow here.
I thought you had more issues with the political environment. Is that not true? Thought we talked about this one thing?
The political environment here?
Yeah. No.
Well, I mean, there are things in the political environment here that are not terribly pro-business, but, I mean, we've never had a lot of issues with it. I mean, it is interesting to me that when you talk about issues that you have with employees, for example, when employees are disgruntled and they quit and they file some grievance against the company, I don't think we've ever had a grievance filed anywhere else in the world. All of them are filed here in California. So there must be something in the water here that makes people want to file grievances. But that's kind of a more of a minor issue. The bigger issue really is just, can a company like us that is trying to grow at the rate that we grow, find everybody that it needs here? And we ultimately came to the conclusion that we couldn't, and that we were going to have a second campus somewhere in order to make sure that we could get everyone that we needed.
Did you invite employees to come to move from Bay Area to Austin? Did anybody take you up on it?
We actually we have had about 6 people move. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much it. But one of the reasons that we picked Austin was that we thought it was a nice enough place that it would not be a hardship to her if someone had to move from here to there. And in fact, the 6 people that have moved have generally been, I would say, very happy. Mm-hmm. Because in all cases, the general profile is someone with a growing family who's living in a house that they're not really thrilled with and a school district they're not too happy with. But it's kind of the best they can afford here in the Bay Area. and they get a chance to move their job to Austin, and all of a sudden they can buy a really nice house in a really nice school district, and it's also a pretty nice town. So I try to think of it as we've got two campuses, and if it makes sense for someone as an individual, or makes sense for their family, or it makes sense for the company, then we, within limits, we try to allow people to live in either place.
Mm-hmm. Any questions from the audience? You can just come to the microphone if you would.
Thank you for that very articulate presentation, very positive. Makes me feel very good to be in a setting like this. So let me ask you about the future. Your calculus of your company, it shows a positive derivative, and probably a steeper derivative than, say, Medtronic and so forth. So what do you see in 5 or 10 years as happening to the medical device business?
Well, we expect to be a growth company for at least the next 5 years. When I look at the things that are in our pipeline, both the things that we're talking about publicly and the things that we're not talking about publicly, I'm more excited about the things that we're going to do over the next 5 years than I am about the things we've done over the last five. We have some really neat stuff that we're planning on doing, and it's going to be a lot of fun to do it. And actually today now, we're a little bit bigger company. We've got more resources. We can actually be a little more ambitious in terms of the projects that we take on, and that makes it even more fun. We're not operating on a shoestring the way we were 10 years ago. We publicly tell people that we expect to grow at least 20% a year for the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I'll be surprised if we don't actually end up doing a bit better than that. Mm-hmm. So I'm frankly quite bullish on the possibilities for innovation and the possibility for innovation to advance the practice of medicine. I was talking to Dr. Yock right before we started, and we were talking about shoulder surgery as an example. 75% of shoulder surgeries are still done open. And the only reason that they're done open instead of being done endoscopic is because the type of repairs that a surgeon needs to make are too hard to make endoscopically, because the tools to do those repairs haven't been developed yet. Well, one of the things we have on our agenda to do is to develop those tools. And 5 years from now, if we can make that number, if we can change it to where 50% or 60% of the surgeries are done endoscopically instead of open, then that's going to be a growth opportunity of enormous proportions for us. And the technology to do that is in-house, and that's the plan in place that we're executing right now. So when you got that kind of thing that you're working on, it's hard not to be excited about it.
How much is managing investor expectations a part of your job? I know when I talk to a lot of folks who are running public companies today, they are, shall I say, frustrated at the fact that the smallest miss in expectations since stock plummeting, and ArthroCare has done extremely well, but mm-hmm. it's been in the early years was a real roller coaster.
that's a nice way to say it. If you were to chart our revenue growth, it looks actually amazingly smooth and generally upward like that. But then if you look at what the stock price has done over the years, it looks like some bizarre psycho roller coaster ride. And investors are either way in front of you or way behind you, and it doesn't matter how strenuously you try to manage them, mm-hmm. they're not very manageable. It's like trying to herd cats with a cattle prod. There's fur flying, and they're screeching and running around, and it's actually pretty much the right visual, I'm telling you the truth. I mean, it is a challenging environment because investors in general are extraordinarily short-term focused, very rumor-driven, in many cases do not really understand the underlying value proposition or drivers in your business and aren't really interested in it there. And so having quality conversations with them, with a lot of them, is difficult. We're fortunate in that we have about 100% of our stock is owned by very much more long-term oriented blue chip, smart money, medical device investment houses with whom we have a good dialogue. I think probably 10 firms own 60% of our stock. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit unusual. Most companies do not have that high an institutional ownership.
I remember when you first got to ArthroCare, you and I talked, the stock was around 7, and then at some point later on, it got to about 72 at one point, and we had a conversation where you said you always thought it was a $35 stock. When it was 70, you thought it was 35, and when it was 72, you thought it was 35. I mean, no one ever wants to discount their stock, but that does speak to the kind of volatility of a public, particularly a small company.
Well, when I joined the company, the stock was at about 2, it's been as high as 160 for about 5 minutes in the middle of a short squeeze. Unfortunately, I wasn't allowed to sell at that point in time. It would have been good. It is very volatile, and a lot of things go on out in the public stock markets that don't really have anything to do with the underlying business of an individual mm-hmm. company. They have to do with trading strategies that different firms are running. And I actually think, and this was, speaks to what we were talking about earlier, you know, when I joined as a CEO 10 years ago, as long as you followed the rules of not giving away confidential information, you could talk fairly openly about your business and your plans to investors and try to educate them about where you were going to go and why. We've had a lot of regulatory changes and legal changes since then, and it is now extremely difficult to talk to investors unless you're talking on a public conference call that everybody listens to. You just can't. And so literally, when I sat down yesterday to talk to a potential investor who visited the company here in Sunnyvale, and you literally have to have somebody else in the room so they can testify to what you said in case you get accused of a Reg FD violation. And you have to spend half an hour before the meeting going over the script of your last conference call to make sure you don't say anything that you didn't say in the last conference call. Mm-hmm. Well, what's the point of having the meeting if you're not going to say anything that you didn't say in your last?
You just give them the transcript of the conference
call. So the quality of information that you're allowed to actually give to an interested investor has declined significantly. And at the same time, the amount of disinformation that's being sort of interjected into the system by aggressive trading firms that are sort of rumor mongering has increased exponentially. And so I kind of feel sorry for investors sometimes because I'm not sure they know really
right.
what to believe.
The irony of it is, of course, that they're getting less good information as part of right. the effort to get them better information.
The regulatory filings that we make get thicker and thicker and thicker, and they contain less and less actual actionable information.
Mm-hmm. We have a question here.
Yes, I had a question about the culture at your company. The way you characterize it, it sounded like it was you really drive towards innovation, and mm-hmm. so I would hope that you could elaborate on how you characterize your full culture. How did you create that culture in the first place, mm-hmm. and how do you keep the continuity in that culture as you expand geographically?
That's really a really good question, a really important issue, and it actually is one of the objectives that my board of directors assigned me a couple of years ago and that I actually spend a lot of time on. One of the big challenges of, I think corporate culture is really important in whether or not you're successful. You've all seen organizations, sports teams, companies, whatever, that year after year, people come and go, money comes and goes, but they just keep winning. And we've also seen organizations that do the opposite. That doesn't matter how much money or talent they've got, year after year, they find a way to lose. And I think a big part of that is the culture of your organization and people understanding who we are, how we do things, what we expect of each other, and having sort of real strong cultural norms about how we do business with one another. And you know, we always had a very strong culture at Arthrocare, and when we were a smaller company in one building, it was easy to maintain it because we saw each other. If somebody was doing something that wasn't culturally compatible, you could wad up a piece of paper and throw it at them. You know, you could call them on it immediately. The challenge now is, you know, when I joined, we had 30 people. Now we've got over 1,000, and they're spread out in facilities around the world. And as I told my management team when we talked about this, you know, the reason that we have issues sometimes with people doing things that are not culturally compatible or not the way we're supposed to do them is because they don't know who we are. Most of the people who work for us today didn't work for us 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And we've got to figure out how we're going to communicate to these folks who we are, how we do things, and what's important and what's not important. And we actually wrote it down. And it took the better part of 2 days to get it all on paper. And it was all the stuff that was in our heads and in the way we did our business that we never said, but was kind of understood. And after you got done writing it down, then you challenge everybody who's in a leadership position to be active in communicating it every chance they get.
And this is different than a mission statement, or is it it's an elaborated?
Sometimes mission statements can be too ambiguous mm-hmm. and too much as if they're written by committee. Mm-hmm. There are good mission statements out there, mm-hmm. but you know, I wanted this to be more specific and to speak directly to our expectations of each other and our expectations of the company and what we were about. And so it's about a page long, small print, and we actually talk about it. I mean, when I go to any facility anywhere, I sit down with all the new employees who haven't met me, and I talk about the stuff that's on that page and challenge them to operate the way that we've operated so that we can all continue to be successful. And it's a little bit of a challenge sometimes because sometimes you're operating with a culture that, well, for example, when I do that in Costa Rica, I have to do it in Spanish because the majority of our employees there don't speak English well enough to do it in English. So, but it's worth the effort. At the end of the day, I actually believe it is going to be a key factor in our success going forward.
Great. Another question?
Well, thank you very much for coming here today. I have a question about your R&D development. I've consulted with dozens of startups and worked for large companies, and the bottom line has been 60 to 70% of the revenue comes from the US, and that's going to be our focal point for developing products. However, having lived in Japan for 10 years and working with startups, when they change the product to meet the need in the Japanese market, profits skyrocketed and often represented 20 to 25% of the revenues, while only maybe 7% of the volume. So my question to you is, to what degree do you believe product development should be done internationally, and specifically in your company, where is your focus on product development geographically? The US only, the US and Japan, the US and Europe, and why?
Most of our product development resources are here in the United States. We have an R&D campus here. It's our biggest one. We have a smaller one in Texas. We also have one in Irvine. We do have some R&D resources in Europe, but they're mostly focused on trying to work collaborations with scientists and physicians in terms of understanding what would be a product or what would be a medical need that we could meet there. So we do a lot of clinical work in Europe, and we do a lot of sort of prospecting for ideas in Europe. We don't do a lot of design or development work in Europe at this point, and we do nothing in Asia other than prospecting for ideas. As I said earlier, we do about one new product a month. A couple of those products every year almost inevitably end up being something that our international business wants that our US business is kind of ambivalent about. So there'll be, because the practice of medicine is different in different parts of the world, and there'll be something that will be very important to the business in Europe or in Asia that will really not be terribly important in the US, and you have to be, you know, open-minded enough to make sure that you do some of those projects, even if it's not something that's going to be important in the U.S. market.
Well, great. Well, I think we really are against our time deadline. Thanks, Mike, again. Thank you all for coming, and there's reception in the back.
Great. Thank you.